I look at my career, like, you know, I tell people, you know, I'm the only guy that's ever dropped a load of water with a CL215 in the Andes Mountains of South America. And I dropped the first load of water north of the Arctic Circle with a CL415. And, you know, I've scooped out of the Pacific Ocean. I've scooped out of the Atlantic Ocean. And I've been pretty much to all the parts in between. And, you know, how do you trump that?
G'day and welcome everyone to episode number 41 of On The Step With That Mallard Guy. I'm your host, Dan Bolton. On The Step is all about float planes and flying boats. I'm still recovering from last week's episode, which had so much incredible seaplane content, and we are about to get back into it with another huge episode. It's like binge seaplaning. How good is it? Now, I know there's a lot of you out there who really enjoy this podcast, so I'm asking you all to make sure you write a review on Apple Podcasts for me if you haven't already done so. It is super easy, takes about a minute, and it inspires me to keep up the hard work for you all. And you can go do it right now while you're listening to me waffle on. It helps the show grow, and who doesn't want that? As always, to get in contact with me, my email is thatmallardguy@hotmail.com, or you can follow me on Instagram and send me a message at thatmallardguy. This week's new patron is Luke Howard, who joined as a Super Cub Floatplane Tier Level member. Luke is a Canadian pilot who has some incredible seaplane experience flying twin otters in the Maldives, Croatia, and also in Denmark at Nordic Seaplanes. I'm hoping to get him on as soon as possible to share his story one day, so keep an ear out for that one as well. You can find him on Instagram under @riverpilot007. He puts some great content up, so go check him out. Thanks, Luke, for your support of the show. Patreon memberships like the one that Luke has joined starts at only $3 a month. That's less than a cup of coffee, and it really means a lot to have that support. I work hard and put a lot into these episodes for everyone's enjoyment, and I'm going to shout out all the patrons who support On The Step. So check out the link in the show notes and join up. Now, as mentioned earlier, folks, this episode is another great one. Recently, I've started interviewing guests from the firebombing world with a couple of awesome fireboss pilots in Australia and Spain. Today, we step it up a notch. Al Hymers is regarded by many as one of the most experienced pilots of the Canadair family of water scooping flying boats. From the 2,100 horsepower side twin radial engined CL215 to the newly modified Pratt & Whitney turboprop CL415 EAF, Al has experienced it all. Not only that, he has experience on the Beach 18, flying that beauty at only 21 years of age, and also the PBY Canso water bomber, the Canadian version of the Catalina. Folks, let's climb up the ladder into the cockpit of our Canadair scooper. Firing up our twin turboprop fire truck of the sky, we'll set the coordinates of the fire we need to go fight. Scanning the area for suitable lakes and rivers near our target, we'll drop down in our giant flying boat, scooping water on the step.
Right engine is turning. 12% fuel. A light.
Alrighty, welcome to On The Step, Al Hymers, all the way from Canada, mate. Great to have you on the show, Al. How are you going?
Very good. Thanks, Dan, for having me. It's looking forward to this. It's a great thing you got going here.
Yeah, thanks, mate. Really looking forward to having you on the show. I've had your name popped up a few times from people who follow me on Instagram, who follow the show, saying that you are one of those guys who knows basically everything about the CL415, the 215Ts, mate. So I'm really excited to get into it. And then, you know, we had a bit of a chat the other day before we did this podcast, and you mentioned that you also flew Catalina or Canzos doing firebombing as well. So it just gets better and better, mate. This is going to be a really good chat, I reckon.
Right on. Yes, I've most of my career is around the scoopers. Fighting fire. Of course, there's guys in Canada have a far more experience than I've got on these things. But I've been around. Just finished my 36th year fighting fire with scoopers.
Yeah, wow, that's incredible, mate. Tell us a little bit about how you got into seaplane flying in general all those years ago.
Well, it probably like a lot of younger kids. I kind of stumbled upon it. I grew up on a small town called Red Rock. It's on the north shore of Lake Superior in Ontario, Canada. And there was no aviation around the area per se. And my family, there was no aviation at all in my family. And when I was a young guy, not even sure, 13, 14 years old, maybe, we were on a little family vacation. Oh, just traveling around the area, camping and stuff. And a small town north of where we lived, there was a family friend that my parents knew. And he was a retired guy who was just working at a fly-in fishing lodge for the summers, flying a Cessna 180 on floats. And we happened to stop there and had a visit with him. He wasn't there, but while we were there, he came in and landed with the 180 and, of course, came into the dock. And we were there, and he was a great guy. Oscar Sedin, his name was. He's passed away a lot of years ago now, but was a bit of a legend in the area. And he kind of saw that I was interested, and I really was. I'd never been around a float plane, never been around really any airplanes at all. And so he kind of took me under his wing and put me in the airplane and showed me a bunch of the stuff and asked me if I'd like to go for a ride. So we did. We went up in the 180, and of course he let me take the controls and fly it a little bit and stuff. And at that point I had never had any aspirations at all. I didn't know anything about aviation, but when we landed back on the dock, I looked at my dad and I said, I'm going to be a pilot. That's what I'm going to do. And here I am. So,
yeah, it's pretty incredible, those stories, isn't it? Like if someone who doesn't really know what they want to do, and then, you know, turns out that they've now spent 36 years of firebombing, you know, it's what an incredible journey.
Yeah, it was. And it was, you know, it was just, you know, happened to be the right place at the right time. And so when I, of course, you know, being young, I don't remember correctly if I was in high school, just starting or about to go into high school. But, of course, I had to finish my secondary school stuff and got out of school. And, of course, you know, as you're graduating out of school, you're doing a lot of this different soul searching of what you're going to do and how you're going to achieve it. And Confederation College in Thunder Bay, Ontario, which was about an hour west of where I live, Confederation College had an aviation flight management program. It was a two-year program that took young kids and basically gave them everything they needed to get a start as a bush pilot. And so when I got out of high school, I applied to Confederation College and went to work in the local paper mill at the same time. And it turned out there was a mix up with my audiogram, because you had to get a Cat 1 medical in order to be prove that you were qualified to be a commercial pilot. Well, by the time there was a mix up with the audiogram, it got lost. By the time transport and stuff, we got it all sorted out, it was too late for the year. All the selections had been made for the course that year. So I actually had to wait an extra year and applied again. And then I got selected into Confederation College. So I graduated from Confederation College in 1979. You come out of there with basically a commercial license, night ratings. You've got your seaplane rating, and then they also give you some training on skis. We had a Cessna 170 on wheel skis that we flew, and a Cessna 172 on floats, and a Cessna 180 on floats. So when I graduated out of the college in the spring of 1979, I was fortunate enough. The industry was kind of booming at the time. There were a fair bit of jobs around, and I was lucky enough. I landed a job in a small town just north of the Ontario-Minnesota border, northwestern Ontario, a little town called Nestor Falls. The company was Northwest Flying Services, and they gave me my start, and I got on a Cessna 185 flying fishing trips, charter work, that kind of stuff for that summer.
Yeah, wow. I mean, when you talked about that, the story there about flying on that 185, I think you said, out with your mate there and expose you to aviation. Was there ever a time when you just wanted to be a pilot and that could be anywhere? Was it airlines or anything, you know, or was it always just bush flying and seaplane flying that captured you straight away?
Well, I think at the time, really, I didn't know anything about even what options were available to you as a young commercial pilot. until I got into the college program and learning and meeting people. And I guess probably because my first flight was on a Cessna 180 on floats. And the fact is the Confederation College, they steer you towards being a bush pilot. Now, many, many guys that come out of that course and great friends of mine all went into the airline environment. Some stayed in the bush. Someone into air traffic control. There's once you get in, you start realizing, wow, there's a great big world out there called aviation that you had no idea about. But for me, I got on the 185 in Nestor Falls, and of course, just loved it. And they were a great company. And I was there for only probably about 6 weeks or so, and then they checked me out on the Beaver. So there I was, a young kid, 20 years old, flying a Beaver. Well, it just couldn't get any better than that. That was the end of the world for me. And then we had two Beach 18s on floats. That fall, they checked me out on the Beach 18. So it asked me to come back and be the relief pilot, spare pilot on the Beach 18 my second season. So there I was, the second season, 21 years old, I'm flying a Beach 18. And again, it could never get any better than that. And of course, your career just progresses. And I spent a couple seasons with that company. And then I moved on to another company south of there in Francis, Ontario, called Rusty Myers Flying Service. And they operated four Beach 18s. So because I was only a relief pilot or spare pilot on the beach in Nestor Falls, they had, of course, full-time guys that were living right there, and that's what they did. So I went full-time with Rusty Myers on their beach crafts and spent 3 years there. And while I was there, that's where the whole, I guess, things took a turn, was on their July 1st weekend, they used to have this big community event called Fun in the Sun. Well, the fire base north of Fort Francis in Dryden, Ontario, which is where I live today, it's still the largest fire base in the province of Ontario. They had the PBY Cancels based here. And they came down on the July 1st weekend to do just a water bombing demonstration there for everybody. And we were standing just up the way there on the docks and watching this show. And I just thought, wow, that's pretty cool. I should probably be doing that. So from that point on, I kind of then steered my way towards getting set up to get into the firebombing game. I really thought that was where I needed to be.
Yeah, that's incredible, mate. And I mean, before we jump into that, I just need to take a step back because, like I said, I got you on here because of your CL415 experience, and then you told me that you flew Canzos, PBYs. That's epic as well. But I haven't had anyone who's been on the show who's flown a Beach 18 on floats yet. So can you take a step back there and tell us a little bit about what it was like to fly that absolute weapon of a machine?
Yeah, it's as far as float planes go, it's probably one of the greatest float planes out there. It's funny because everybody you talk to that ever flew a Beach 18 on floats, it doesn't matter where you are or what the conversation or what the setting is, the conversation will always end up back to flying the Beach 18. It's a phenomenal airplane. And of course, being a young kid still, I was just in awe. But I remember, when I first, got flying the 185, and I'd look in that Beechcraft, and of course there's, two throttles, and there's two prop levers and two mixtures, and there's oil cooler bypasses, and there's fuel systems, and there's transfers, and there's, switches. And I just thinking, oh my goodness, how could you ever remember what all those things are for, it really is. It's a sweetheart of an airplane. And anybody who's ever flown a Beach 18 will never have a bad thing to say about it. It is the perfect float plane. It really is. And I loved it. I loved that airplane.
Yeah. And what was its main purpose there? Was it transporting passengers around? Why was the Beach 18, a good float plane for people to use? Obviously it had two big radial engines, the same as the Beaver, weren't they? So why weren't two Beavers better off than a Beach 18?
Well, the Beach 18, first of all, it's a bigger airplane. It's uh, it carries a big load. It's faster than the Beavers and stuff. It had a longer range. You could travel, but basically they were used the same as the Beavers, the Otters, any of that stuff was. It was all set outs for fishermen. They fly in summer fishermen, charter work, hunting trips in the fall, that kind of stuff. And it's a great airplane. It was well suited in the bush. It's tough, it's built extremely tough, and it can take a beating. And if you look, there's Beech 18s are still flying today up in this area, and although they're getting fewer and fewer, but there's still quite a few of them flying around. And they've been operating on floats now for upwards of 50 years, and they're still going strong. So that's just a testament to the aircraft. It's a beautiful. It's very stable to fly. It's fast. It's a great airplane.
Yeah, it sounds like the key to success for a bush plane is just something that absolutely lasts forever, isn't it? Like these things, like the Beavers, the Beech 18s, the Otters, they all get smashed in these bush environments, but they just keep on going, don't they?
They do. They really do. And you can take the Cessnas, which are good float planes, that kind of stuff. But really, they show their age quickly. And like you say, they take the ruggedness of the de Havilland products or the Beech 18s and stuff. And they just keep going. They're like the Maytags. They just keep going.
Yeah, exactly. And mate, touching back there about that story there, where jumping on a Beech 18 at 21 years old, is it probably more of a factor of there was a lot more opportunity back then, say, compared to these days with flying? Or would you put your success down to being a real hard worker as well? Probably a combination of both of those things. But, to jump on a twin radial at the age of 21, it sounds like there's some incredible opportunities there back in the day to build those hours.
Yeah, and there was, there was certainly more opportunity. There was more airplanes operating for sure, because of course in the far north, and that, most of this, the communities, the First Nations communities and stuff, were all serviced by float planes, ski planes in the wintertime, which now today have all fully serviced, runways and stuff. So a lot of that flying has gone by the wayside. But I said also too, I guess, the people that at Northwest Flying, they were fantastic. They saw a guy that had some desire, maybe a little bit of ability, and they weren't afraid to give you a chance. I know other companies in the north and had, like, you had to be God to fly a Beech 18. It was, they wouldn't even consider you to fly one until you had probably had about 5,000 hours, and I think I had 700 or 800 hours when I was checked out on one, But it was just, it was fortunate. I got the break, and the company, they weren't afraid to give a guy a chance, and he did some good training with it. The guys I flew with and trained on it, guys, Jack Pope, Jimmy Swamp, people like that, these guys were very, very seasoned. A guy like Edwin Showalter's another legend in Northwestern Ontario. He was our chief pilot at the time, and I flew with him and trained with him. So they give you some fantastic training too. So they weren't just throwing you to the wolves. You hear the stories of, just load up the airplane and go. Well, that's not the case. They worked with you and flew with you. And when you were ready, they weren't afraid to cut you free. And I was very fortunate that that's what happened.
Yeah. And look, I have heard some other stories about the other way around, like I think Kurt Miller on talking about flying the Mallard on the west coast of Canada there was saying that, to get some time on a Mallard, you had to have thousands of, especially west coast Canada flying time, So sometimes you hear stories about it going the other way as well. So now that's incredible. They gave you that shot early, and obviously that really helped with your career.
Yeah, it absolutely did, and of course it also is, no kidding aside, it's the cycle of the industry too, and we all know aviation works in cycles, and it all depends on when you hit it. And I was fortunate enough that when I come out of Confederation College as a young commercial pilot with the ink still wet on my license, I had five job offers to go to, you know, fast forward maybe 5 years, and you know, the kids coming out of the same program 5 years later, there isn't a job to be had, you know. So it's, you know, it's timing for sure. It's when you hit the industry, and I happened to hit it, you know, at a very good time. There was lots of jobs, and pilots were in demand, and so it paid off well as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, mate, tell us, you know, you're at that little air show you were talking about there, and the PBY Canso, which is the same as a Catalina for those who don't know the difference there. You know, doing a water bombing show for you. Tell us about how you made that transition there from being a Beach 18 pilot to getting on that aircraft and starting to get into firebombing.
Well, there was two companies in Canada at the time that were, there was a few of the governments, Newfoundland government, Quebec government, Saskatchewan government, that operated their own Cansos. But there was two private companies in Canada that contracted out their services. And one was this company, Avalon Aviation, in Parry Sound, Ontario. And then there was the Flying Fireman out of Victoria, British Columbia. So I started sending off resumes, and I really didn't know anybody in the bombing industry at all. So I started sending off resumes, and I got some books. Actually, there's a couple of good firefighting books. One, Ed Linkwich, I think, is the author of one. And anyways, they've been around. And so I started reading up on it and studying up on it and learning what I could know about it. And then I started calling the chief pilots. And and there's no doubt about it. You know, the transition to the PBY off of the Beach 18 is, you know, it's a natural progression. I at that time I probably had, I don't know, 2,500 hours pilot and command time on a Beach 18 on floats. So that certainly opens some doors for you when you're talking to these chief pilots and stuff. And it turned out anyways, I got a call in the spring with Avalon Aviation, and I got hired on as a co-pilot on the PBY, and I spent the summer on that airplane. And to back it up just a little bit, what happened was prior to the also was as looking into all this stuff, not knowing much about it, I found out that the government of Canada was in the process of setting up a national water bomber fleet across the country. And they had a deal going for every one the provinces bought of the CL-215s, for every one they bought, the Canadian government, the federal government, would give you one.
Oh, wow.
So anyways, I found out that Ontario was to receive 9 of these brand new CL-215s. So I thought, okay, well, this is probably where I need to be heading. So that's what I had my sights set on that already. And then I started applying to the Ontario Provincial Air Service at the time. And then I spent the summer on the PBY, you know, of course, networking and meeting people. And I actually got the opportunity to work in the circuit with some CL-215s and which was really impressive, because that's, you know, the PBY was, you know, when you get on that, you think, wow, this is pretty cool. This thing's got 104-foot wingspan. It's, you know, it scoops up, you know, 8,000 pounds of water, and it drops it out the belly and stuff. And it was great, other than, you know, it was an old bird, and, you know, it, even though it was pre-World War II stuff. And but even that in itself, I remember thinking about this whole PBY, thinking, wow, this, you know, for 1930s technology, like, it had electric carb heats, it had electric retractable wing floats and stuff. And you think, wow, this thing, you know, for its age, it's pretty impressive what they were doing in the 30s. But you could tell its day had come. And the companies knew that, because, of course, this new national water bomber fleet was going to be established utilizing CL-215. So the days of PBYs being contracted were coming to an end. So I spent one season with Avalon Aviation, and then of course they had no contracts, no work the next season. So I got talking with the flying firemen out of British Columbia, and they actually had the Ontario contracts. They had the last of the Ontario contracts until the CL-215s arrived. So I got hired that season with them, and actually came to Ontario and did a season. In fact, in the base I'm at right now in Dryden, Ontario. And then, so flew that season. It was a very slow season. There wasn't much going on. It was a rainy season. So it was one of those seasons, as you learn over the years, you just you grow to hate those seasons.
Yeah, right.
And you do experience them, you know, over your course of your career. But then I ended up with an interview with the Ontario Provincial Air Service, and I got on the what they call an eligibility list to be hired. And the next season, I got offered a job. It was my choice. They said, either you can fly a standard otter or a turbo beaver for us. And I could pick which one I wanted. And I selected the turbo beaver. And then that would have been in, I guess, January of 1986. I was planning on going there then, because the PBYs were being phased out. The 215s were arriving. And I knew, okay, this was going to be probably my ticket into the CL-215. And I got a call about 6 weeks later from the chief pilot in Sault Ste. Marie, Ontario, and asked me, he said, instead of a turbo beaver job in Red Lake, Ontario, would you like to go right seat on a CL-215 that we're taking delivery of two, and we're lining up crews right now. We're not sure exactly what's happening. We don't know really anything, but with your PBY time, would you like to go right seat on a CL-215? So, you know, of course, the rest is history, and it certainly didn't take me long to think about the answer to that question. So,
yeah, and here you are now, still flying the aircraft. That's pretty incredible.
Yes. So things moved along pretty quick after that. And I got on the CL-215 that spring. And I spent two seasons in the right seat of the CL-215. And, of course, with Ontario, we had nobody that knew anything about these airplanes or how to operate them. So they brought over French pilots from Quebec and the province of Quebec. And these guys, of course, were highly experienced guys, professional. They're still recognized as the best of the best as far as bombing industry goes. These guys had, you know, years of operating CL-215s already, and so I got crewed up with a captain, Paul Berube, great guy, still one of a great friend of mine, and I spent a summer with him, and based out of Thunder Bay, Ontario, and it was great. And then the next season, we were getting more airplanes, I got based in Dryden, Ontario, where I am today, crewed up with Captain Roger Boutan, who is a legend as far as around the world, as far as these scoopers go. And I spent a season with him, and these guys, you know, took me under their wing and taught me what I needed to know and how not to kill myself and how to fight fire. And here I am.
Yeah, wow. So what was the big thing that the CL-215 had over the PBY at the time? Was it because it was a new manufactured aircraft, and obviously the PBY was so old and was kind of, there probably wasn't that many left in the world. What were the main advantages there?
Well, it was the main advantage, of course, it was new, right? It was modern. You know, the maintenance, what probably wasn't as good as it could have been, the spare parts, you know, supply was probably getting limited, nor did companies want to be spending huge money on airplanes that they knew their days were coming to an end. You know, we get this new fleet of airplanes. They're brand new. They carry more water. They're more maneuverable. They got more horsepower. They're faster. A CL-215 is just everything you ever wished the PBY could be.
Yeah, wow.
And I remember flying in the circuit in the PBY, and of course the CL-215s would come and they would just scoop alongside you, and up over the hill they'd go, and you know, you'd lumber out straight ahead and have to go around the hill to, you know, get going to the fire and stuff. And yeah, they just, they actually, it was the CL215 that actually revolutionized firefighting in certainly, probably in Canada, but certainly in Ontario for sure. It just changed how fires were fought because it was so efficient. So
yeah, wow. And just jumping back there a little bit as well for the PBY stuff, it was incredible to hear you kind of talk about how you got onto the PBY there, and then almost straight away you were kind of thinking about going on to another aircraft. Obviously the CL215 had started to come out and was probably pretty exciting for the time there. But was that straight away, did you know straight away that the PBY was kind of going to be phased out soon enough? It had kind of done its time. And also on top of that, what was it actually like to fly that aircraft?
Yeah, the PBY, at the time, no. But of course, once you get into the company and, you know, you get talking to the senior guys and, you know, guys have been in the industry. And, you know, I flew with the guy I was fortunate enough to fly with on the PBY the first year, Larry Roloff. He was, again, he actually had retired from Canadair, the builders of the CL215, and he had flown all over the world in the CL215s doing demos. There was virtually no parts of the world he hadn't been with one. So you know, when you're around these sort of people all the time and senior captains and stuff, they got the, you know, they know what the history or what the future is going to hold and what history is going to write. And they knew that the PBY was done. It was just a matter of time. It was just, at that point, it was just a fill-in stopgap until Canadair could produce enough of these CL215s and get them pushed across the country. So yeah, that's when I realized that, even though I loved the PBY, I quickly realized though it's shortcoming. It doesn't maneuver very well. It doesn't, you know, it's cumbersome. It kind of, you know, it's slow. It, you know, cruises about 105, 110 knots. You got this big airplane that's just kind of lumbering through the sky. But again, it was cool. I love flying it. I look back and I think I'm very fortunate to have been able to fly it. And of course, I know guys, you know, and good friends of mine who have spent many years flying them, and they probably would. Probably don't have quite as good a memory as I do because I didn't get a whole lot of time on it. But the time I did get on it, it was and firefighting. It was the first time, you know, when you're heading into, you know, the flames on a forest fire to punch out a bunch of water on it. It's pretty exciting stuff. And, you know, you think, oh, well, coming out of bush flying, you know, all the low level stuff, the bad weather, the, you know, sneaking across treetops and stuff like that you do on a daily basis, you know, and it can get pretty hair-raising at times. But there is nothing that I had done at that point in my career that would ever have prepared me for heading into the head of a forest fire.
Yeah, and, wow.
So, again, you know, I was lucky, like a guy like Larry Roloff, he'd been doing it for so many years, and so he was able to teach me a lot and basically taught me about firefighting and then flying the Canso. And so it was, I was very fortunate that I got that opportunity, but it didn't take long when you're lumbering around in a circuit in hot weather and, you know, like the PBY, if I remember correctly, it's like 2.5 turns on the wheel for full aileron deflection, you know, from stop to stop and stuff. And you know, it maneuvered, like, you know, guys used to say, don't ever let a wing down because you never know if that wing's going to come back up again. You know?
Oh, wow.
So it had its shortcomings, but again, for the technology from, you know, 1930s, it was bloody amazing.
Yeah, it's incredible that this World War II era aircraft, you just get to jump in and throw it around and you know, dive bomb fires. You know, it's insane to think that you can do that with that old nostalgic aircraft.
Yeah, or why would you? You know, but again, it was back. You know, the Ontario Provincial Air Service pretty much wrote the book on water bombing. you know, they're back in the 40s. They were already experimenting with, you know, beavers and stuff with the, and, you know, of course, they ultimately ended up with their, you know, their beavers and standard otters. They had Nordine Norsemans even at one point that they would, with rollover tanks and stuff, and they were bombing fires with those. And so, you know, the PBY came along and somebody had the idea, well, we could cut some holes in the bottom of this thing and do the same thing. And really it was ingenious because the airplane really was a marvel at you know, at the, in its time for what it was doing on forest fires. Cause it was the greatest thing because there was nothing else out there, you know?
Yeah.
Of course, the CL-215 showed up on the scene, and it didn't take many circuits around a fire in a circuit with a CL-215 to realize that, wow, there's the future right there. You know, that's where it's going.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about the 215 and a few stats, maybe a little bit, you know, about when that came on and, you know, what it was like, because it was a big airplane as well, wasn't it?
Yes, it was bigger than the PBY. Wingspan was shorter, but it had a gross, it grosses out at 43,500 pounds.
Wow.
Where the PBY Canso was around, if I remember correctly, it was around 28,000 somewhere. So the PBY carried 8,000 pounds of water. The 215 carried 12,000 pounds of water. It had, the PBY had the Pratt & Whitney 1830 engines, which were 1,200 horsepower aside, and the CL-215 had the Pratt & Whitney R2800s, which were 2,100 horsepower aside. So you had way more power, way more, you know, bigger loads. And, of course, the CLs are the only aircraft to this day even that are out fighting fire that were designed and built for only one purpose, and that's to fight forest fires.
Yeah.
And every other aircraft out there that's fighting fires today started out life as something else. It was designed to be something else. And when it was done that life for whatever reason, then it was converted over. But the CLs are built with only one purpose, to fight fire, and that's why they do it so well. It's you know, they're maneuverable, they're powerful, they have great visibility of them. They're comfortable to fly. Although the CL-215 at the time, one would argue that it wasn't that comfortable. Of course, you got all the glass around you. It was very, very hot and fatiguing to fly because your flight controls were just manual. Everything was cable pulleys. There was no hydraulic assisted controls. There was no air conditionings. There was just a couple of small air vents to let air into the cockpit. And so flying the CL-215, even though it was just the most awesome firefighting aircraft out there, it was a beast to fly. It was, yeah. You know, it was hot. You get into hot turbulence and stuff. Like, there's days where you just, at the end of the day, you just, you know, you're soaking wet with sweat. It's, you know, we always used to laugh. You can always tell the 215 pilots at the end of the day because they're the guys with their knuckles scraping across the asphalt on the tarmac. You know,
yeah.
It really did take its toll on you, but again, it did a wonderful job. You could wing that thing around. It was extremely maneuverable,
yeah.
and reliable.
So, mate, are you trying to say that, you know, this is the only aircraft that's ever been built for the purpose of firefighting, and, you know, in these incredible hot environments, and they didn't put an air conditioner in the aircraft?
Yeah, unbelievable, eh?
were these pilots who were building this airplane? Come on, like, seriously?
Well, I don't know. I think there was somebody that didn't like pilots. I don't know. It's funny because they did everything right. You know, the visibility out of it was superb. But of course, then with that superb visibility, it was like sitting in a greenhouse,
yep.
You know, on a hot summer day with the sun beating in on you. So really, it did. It was very, very fatiguing flying the airplane for long periods of time. But again, when you're dropping, you know, you're going out and, you know, sometimes you're dropping, you know, 150 loads a day, you know, 100 loads, 120 loads in a single day. you know, it's just that in itself, you know, can be pretty grueling. But in that environment, it really was. But again, it goes back to the PBY, the same thing. You never knew any different. That's all you knew. Yeah. It was the greatest thing out there. And to fly that thing, you had to sweat a little bit. But again, it was just a great experience flying that aircraft.
Yeah. So, mate, I kind of understand that a little bit with the Mallard. You know, especially up in Darwin here, we don't have air conditioning. And, you know, up in the tropics of Darwin, you know, we're taxiing out for departure. And there's absolutely no airflow through the cabin. We're absolutely sweating bullets as well. But, you know, we're just on the runway. We're not actually fighting fires and, you know, doing 120 laps of a you know, water scooping area. So it's a little bit different. But with the Mallard as well, it was an aircraft that was originally radial engine. And in the late 60s, early 70s, it was modernized to the turbine engines. When did they realize for the Canadair 215 there that maybe the turbine option was a better one, or did it originally come with that turbine option?
No, it operated for a lot of years. I think it was in the 60s. It would have been in the late 60s, I guess, probably when Quebec started taking delivery of their first 215s. Some of the other provinces ended up, Manitoba ended up, so Ontario ended up, I think it was in the 80s, early, it was probably around 82 or so when we took delivery of our first two airplanes. At the time when the 215 was being built, there was no turbine available that could produce the horsepower that was required, you know, and the spool up time and stuff that was needed to be able to work that thing in a fire environment. So they leaned on the old piston, being the Pratt & Whitney 2800. Again, a fantastic airplane, but it was also 50 years old. You know, so as time went on, probably would have been through the 80s is when we started hearing early 80s, mid 80s, when we started hearing talk of turbinizing. You know, the engines were getting tired. The part supply was, there were still lots of parts around, but just the maintenance, the airplane itself, the 215 was fantastic as far as a maintenance platform goes, or ease of maintenance. But the engines were the problem. 90% of the probably the maintenance on that airplane was engine related. So the engineers, they paid they worked hard. They paid a huge price in the summertime because you get into fire flaps and you've got 9 CL215s operating like we had in Ontario here. There's never a day when probably all 9 were online. And if they were, it was rare. There was always one down with a cylinder change, a nose case change, a carburetor change, you know, oil leaks or a complete engine change. And those guys, it wasn't uncommon for those guys. You'd get done in the evening and you know, you're packing up your stuff and they're bringing out we never even had hangars at the time, and they'd be bringing out the engine stands and floodlights and stuff, and they'd be going to work because you've got an engine problem, and they would work all night. And you would show up the next day, maybe 9, 10 o'clock in the morning, and they have it buttoned up or just be buttoning it up. And they've been there all night working on these things. And people recognize that there something needed to change. And, the reliability was getting less and less. And of course, and with the new turbine, the evolution of the turbine engines as well coming, then they decided that they would look at it. So Bombardier then bought it, which had bought out Canadair. They started design work on it and stuff, and it was by probably the early 90s they were flying them, doing the flight testing and stuff on the CL415 or the CL215Ts with the turbines. So then they became available. France became the launch customer, and it was through the launch France that Bombardier went ahead with the production, and that's where we are today. The 215 faced pretty much the same demise as the PBY did. It, you know, it was the big boy on the block, and eventually got replaced by the next generation. And and of course, the CL-415 is certainly the ultimate in firefighting. So.
Yeah, right. Was it another step up like it was for, you know, the PBY to the 215? Was it another step up when you went to the 415?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. It was, again, the same thing as the 415 was just everything you ever wished the 215 could be. You know, we had, we had hydraulic assisted controls. We had air conditioning.
We had
modern cockpits. We had turbine engines. So we've taken now like 90% of the maintenance problems that we had and eliminated those. And the 415 became and it still is. It's the ultimate in firefighting. It's the Cadillac for sure in firefighting. Wow. So,
mate, tell us a little bit what it's like, as a pilot these days to fly the 415 there out to a fire. What's a day in the life of Al flying a 415 out to a fire?
Well, it's certainly much different than what it was back in the day. When I started on the PBYs, and of course you've probably, you talk to any air tanker guys, whether they're land-based or scooper guys or whatever, back in the day it was, you kissed your family goodbye in the spring and off you went for the fire season, not quite sure where or when you're going to meet again. And you just went to work. And for myself, when I got on the PBY, that's what it was. It was, you signed a contract, 143-day contract, and you went to work. And the family's left behind. It's hard on everybody, those environments. And even with the 215, with the advent of the 215, we worked 14 days on. We got one day off. And I was living in Fort Frances, Ontario still. I was married, my wife, and I had just had a young son. He was a few months old. And so I'd be gone 14 days and I could get home for one day. It was about a 4-hour drive to get home. So I'd get home that night late, depending on what was happening in the fire situation. The next day I would have off, but I would have to either leave that evening to go back, or sometimes I could stay the second night and leave like real early in the morning to get back to base to meet the alerts or take the airplane to another base if we were being base changed or whatever. But usually one night at home every couple of weeks, that was it. And, then as time went on with Ontario, once we got everything in place, the 9 airplanes we started negotiating salary packages and working conditions and stuff. And we ended up, Ontario agreed to a 12 days on, 3 day off contract. So that was huge. We were the only one. We were the envy of Canada because we were the only people actually getting scheduled days off back then. And that was revolutionary. The fact is that you could actually, go away for 12 days and then you could be brought back home for 3 days to spend with your family. Now of course it's 10 day here in Ontario. They work 10 days on, 4 days off. And if you look south of the border and places like that, it's pretty much common now where it's a 2-week rotation. So you're on 2 weeks, off 2 weeks. So it's come light years from where it used to be. You can have a home life. You can have, my wife used to say that I would be home just long enough to screw up the routine and I'd be gone again. And so nowadays it's, the guys nowadays on the 415, of course, it's a much easier airplane. You can fly that thing all day long and get out of it and feel good. The PBY, the 215, you were beat. You were physically beat after a full day of flying. So nowadays, the flight time is less, and that was one of the things that really surprised a lot of people with the 415. when the 215s and the PBYs, they always tracked how many hours on average the airplanes flew. And with the 415 came, those numbers dropped probably by 25 to 30%. And even myself noticed that as it was the amount of hours that you fly are less. And it's because the airplane's that much more efficient. It's faster. It gets out there faster. It can do faster turnarounds. It's dropping more water. Therefore, it can get the fire knocked down that much faster, and you're back home. So it's, you know, a typical fire day, it varies, you know, again, on season to season, week to week, depending on rainfall. But it's one of these jobs, I've always said, it's either you're so bored to death you can't stand it, or you're so busy you can't stand it. So it's, you know, it's, you get into these big fire flaps and fires are burning everywhere, and, you know, they're starting up, and you're just you know, expected to be everywhere at once. And then you'll get into a patch of the rains come through, and it rains every day, and you might go a couple of weeks and not even get in the cockpit. And so it just varies. It's so unpredictable, and it's so dependent on the weather as to what kind of a day you have, what kind of a season you have.
Yeah, it's incredible to think as well that, like, your main career is something that's so devastating to other people in a way as well, isn't it? Like, I've spoke to it before about, you know, some of the guys who've flown the Fireboss, that the busier you are, the kind of worse things could be on the ground for people with homes, etc., and forests. And so how do you deal with that kind of aspect of it all?
Yeah, that part is, it is tough. And we've been into some tough spots where it's, you know, it certainly takes the joy out of the job when you're seeing, you know, people losing everything. And it's like I had one captain describe it to me one time. We had lost a fire, and he was really upset about it. And he said it's like a doctor losing a patient sort of stuff. He said, you know, where, you know, the doctor has done everything in his power to save that person and was unable to save it. And he said, I feel a lot like that. He said, when I'm fighting a fire, I've done everything in my capability to stop that fire, and I wasn't able to do it. And there's that, you know, sense of loss, I guess, it's the nature of the job. You got to try and remove yourself from that. Where we are in Ontario, of course, we've been very fortunate. We have so much water up here, and with the fleet of scoopers that we have, we don't lose a lot of place. Don't get me wrong, we've bombed fires in the backyards of houses, and, you know, we've bombed chip piles at lumber mills and stuff, and we've always just kind of seemed to be able to stop it. And I alluded to earlier was the CL215 really was the one that changed it, revolutionized the whole firefighting strategy in Ontario. And what happened when in Ontario used to be was of course the ground firefighters go in, and they go in and attack it. And when they can't handle it, they call for the air support, which the PBYs would go. And, you know, of course, the middle of the afternoon, peak heating period, the winds are up, and you'd be doing whatever you can to support these guys, and you can't stop it. And when the 215 came, it was the same way, but fire managers quickly realized that, whoa, why are we sending these fire crews first? Why aren't we sending that airplane first? And that's what they ended up doing. So the CL215 quickly became the frontline attack platform fires, for initial attack. And of course the fire, there was a lot of animosity back then. We weren't the most well-liked guys because of it, because the fire crews, the ranger crews in Ontario, they went from being like the frontline go get them guys to basically going in behind when the airplane's done, and they go in and take over and mop the fire up and actually extinguish it. But the airplane actually, and even to this day, it's the initial attack. It's the one that gets the call to go. So if there's a report of a smoke or anything like that, it's like, get a couple airplanes in the air. You know, they'll launch helicopters with crews and stuff at the same time. But the airplane is basically the initial attack platform that goes out. And if the airplane, with the environment we're in here, again, with the water and stuff, if the airplane can't stop the fire, can't get it knocked down, well, there was no way that the fire crews were ever going to be able to do it anyway. Again, we in Ontario here, we haven't really experienced a lot of loss. We've lost some cottages, we've lost some, you know, tourist camps, outpost camp, that kind of stuff. But we've been very, very fortunate and probably more luck than anything at times, where we've never actually burnt up a town or subdivisions or stuff like that. So, but I have worked, you know, in the U.S. enough to, you know, and of course it's a whole different way of fire down there. It's a whole different, they deal with much more extreme temperatures. Of course, they got the terrain, they got mountains, they got, in Southern California, the Santa Ana winds. And there's times when you get into drought conditions and 50 mile an hour winds blowing, and there is just nothing. There is nothing out there that can stop a fire. And I've flown over and I've seen where, you know, you just see the basements of houses and stuff, and you just, you get sick to your stomach. But you have to be able to pull yourself out of that and realize that, you've done what you can do, and there's nothing more to do. Because if you let it really play on you or eat at you, you probably would be getting to the point where you'd be in an unsafe situation where you'd need to go and sit on the ground for a bit. So you just do your job the best you can and hope for the best.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And obviously it's a great job that you guys all do. And obviously everyone out there is incredibly thankful for what you do to help prevent, you know, the loss of property and forests and everything there. So well done to you. Do you know of anything, any news or anything about these aircraft coming to Australia? I know that we've had a bit of help from Conair, bringing over some more wheeled-based aircraft. But have you heard anything, in the pipeline for getting some 415s in Australia?
Yes, there actually is. There was hope. In fact, the company I'm associated with now was talking with the Australian government, trying to secure a contract over there. And we'd like to get a couple of scoopers over there and, help out. And, saw what went on. Of course, it doesn't matter where you are in the world. And it wouldn't matter if you're flying scoopers or air tankers or you see that kind of tragedy unfolding, and you know you've got a tool that can help and possibly make a difference. You want to be there and do what you can to help. But unfortunately, I don't know the reasons why, but the politics, whatever, I'm not sure. I'm not into that department of things. Yeah. But as it stands right now, anyways, there's companies that certainly, I know in the past in Ontario here, we had done flight planning a couple of times over the years about getting the 415s to Australia to help out. And then for some reason, it just never, ever happened.
The fire boss, has picked up in Australia here. That I think there's about 9 or 10 this year, compared to only a couple of seasons ago. So maybe with the increase of those scoopers, we can maybe then see some 415s. But here's hoping that the next couple of years, the fire seasons in Australia are a little bit less intense to what they were last year, especially because that was it was a brutal season.
You're definitely due for a break. There's no doubt about it. Last year was just absolutely unbelievable, seeing the footage coming out of Australia.
Yeah, that was pretty bad. Mate, in 2016, there was an announcement that Viking Air would take over the purchase of the type certificates for the 415. 215 and the 215T as well. There's also been a little bit of talk about this new EAF version, the Enhanced Aerial Firefighter version of the 415, and then also the news of a CL515. Can you tell us a little bit about those developments?
Yeah, as it stands right now, the Viking owns all of the type certificates for sure. Not only they also own all the de Havilland products, but also the CL products, and of course the 415 production has been stopped. It was stopped for a year or two prior to them buying them out from Bombardier. The CL215T program, which ultimately is the CL415 EAF program, is in full swing. A company I'm associated with now in Bozeman, Montana, Bridger Aerospace, they've the launch customer. They've purchased six of the CL215Ts, which they're being branded right now as the CL415 EAF, but they're not quite there yet. All the new cockpits and stuff, it's all still in the production stage. So what we did in order to get airplanes out working and online, we've built them, or Viking has built them to the 215T specs. So what we operate right now, we have two this year we operated, which are actually two of the old CL215s that I flew back in Ontario. the CL215Ts right now are the old cockpit still, with some modernized the IDS, the instrument display systems, and that for the, and of course turbines and stuff. But we will end up with four of those. And then the last two we get, number five and six, will be the EAF. They'll have the new Collins Proline Fusion cockpit and stuff in them. And once they're operating, then the first four will go back in, and they'll be retrofitted to all the upgrades to make them the CL415 EAF. So that's where that's at. They're right now, I believe there is 11... there's 11 airframes sitting that will be converted as of now. Bridger has ordered six, as I mentioned. We have options for two more that the decision has been made yet on them. And I know the province of Saskatchewan is getting one more. I'm not sure who else, but also on the drawing boards, the engineers in the back rooms are also looking at the CL515. Now, where that is actually at, I'm not sure. It's still on the drawing board, as far as I know. And we keep hoping that there will be an announcement coming at some point. But of course, what it'll come down to is dollars. And somebody has to come forward and be the launch customer of, somebody wants to step up and launch and place an order for the 515s, then they will become the future.
Yeah, and I read something about the 515 there, that they would have instruments for IFR flight. So does that mean that everything basically you've been doing is not in the IFR world?
No. The 215s, 415s, 215Ts are all fully IFR capable. We fly them IFR. Pretty much most of the work we do is VFR with them, of course, because of firefighting stuff. But they are IFR capable. All the pilots are IFR capable. The only difference with the 215 or the CL515 that I'm hearing is that they would like to increase the water load, so it'll carry a bigger load, more horsepower. You know, a little more modernization into the airframe and stuff, but basically, it sounds like it's just going to be a 415 on steroids. So
another step up, maybe.
Another step up. Correct.
Exactly. Yeah. Now the advanced aerial firefighter is that also a step up from, you know, like we've been speaking about, each one kind of comes out and does something new. You know, what's so much more enhanced about that aircraft?
Well, it's just the CL215T itself. It's it started life as a CL215, and of course they turbinized it, and it maintains the same bomb system, the two door drop system, versus the 415 that has a four door drop system. It carries a little bit smaller load. It's a lighter airframe, but it's got the same horsepower. And like the guys in Quebec like to refer, they've always said that the CL415 is the Cadillac, but the T is the Ferrari. Yeah, and it really does. It's a lighter airframe and has the same amount of horsepower. So basically what the EAF will do is it'll modernize the cockpit. Right now we have the older steam gauges still, and so it'll be a complete glass cockpit with flight management systems. It'll be we're going to have forward-looking infrared FLIR systems, forward-looking infrared capability. And there's also, there's talk of increasing the water load on it, to increasing the tank size to the same as the CL415. But I think the jury is still out on that yet, and not sure if that will actually come to fruition, because it's a great airplane where it's at right now. Especially in the United States, the work we've been doing with it in the higher elevations, we're up in 8,000-9,000 foot elevations, dropping on fires and stuff, and on hot days. And I've been in the circuit with the 415s, and of course I've flown the CL415s down in that environment as well. And it definitely has a leg up on the 415 in those higher elevations and the hot temperatures and that, with it the way it is. So personally, I'm thinking that if they just left it the way it is, just put the new cockpit in it and modernize all the instrumentation and stuff, I think they'll have a winning platform for sure.
Yeah, sounds good. Now, mate, you mentioned before that, these aircraft are specifically designed for firefighting use, and most other aircraft for that reason are designed some other way, and then they're kind of brought into the firefighting world. Do you think that there's potential that this aircraft could be the reverse of that and maybe be designed to do like passenger carrying stuff, for example?
Yeah, probably not, because if you look inside it, it's pretty rustic inside. It's a fire truck, it's built to be a fire truck. And
yep.
I guess if you looked at the fire truck at the local fire hall and say, hey, let's turn this into a school bus.
Yeah, right.
it's just they have different roles and different priorities, and I don't ever see it. I know the seals, they're spray booms and stuff that can be fitted to them, and they could actually do spraying like for oil spills, that kind of stuff. But it's virtually all special purpose type work that airplane would do. It would never be in the passenger role at all.
Yep. No, fair enough. Well, Al, it's been awesome, mate, having this chat with you. Just before we wrap things up, we're going to jump into the splash and dash questionnaire, just like the land plane touch and go. The seaplane splash and dash. We'll just touch on a few seaplane related questions. I think I know the answer to this one, since you've been flying the aircraft for so long now, but what's been your favorite seaplane that you've ever flown? Like, there's been a fair few over your career, so maybe there's one in the past that you could bring up again.
Well, there's no doubt that, the Beech 18 again, and I remember, I spent nine seasons in the Maldives flying the Twin Otters, and of course there's, the Twin Otter is the ultimate float plane. There's no getting around it. But guys say to me, even they ask me that question, what's the best one? I always say the Beech 18. And they'd say, well, what about the Twin Otter? I said, well, I was 21 years old flying a Beech 18, and I was 50 years old flying a Twin Otter. It's just not the same, but the Twin Otter is fantastic. But if I look at the 215s, the 415s, and I look at my career, I tell people, I'm the only guy that's ever dropped a load of water with a CL215 in the Andes Mountains of South America. And I dropped the first load of water north of the Arctic Circle with a CL415. And, I've scooped out of the Pacific Ocean. I've scooped out of the Atlantic Ocean. And I've been pretty much to all the parts in between. And, how do you trump that? That airplane is, It's just allowed me to see and do, and the people I've met, by doing this job is just absolutely unbelievable. So there's definitely, you know, the, now the CL215T, which one is, you know, the T is, there's no doubt it's a Ferrari. The 415 is great to fly, but it'd be the CL products for sure would have to stand out as the ultimate, I guess, of in my career.
Yeah, I guess one thing, first of all, I'd never even touched on the fact that you'd spent 9 seasons in the Maldives. It's pretty hard to wrap up a guy's career who's been flying for, 40-odd years in an hour and a half. So we didn't touch on that. But I've had enough people talk about what it's like to fly over there. We can just focus on the firebombing stuff with yourself. I didn't really touch on as well, you know, the whole flying boat versus float plane thing. How did you find the transition from float planes to flying boats?
They have their own little unique set of characteristics, but really one to the other is with my background, which I guess most guys involved in this stuff is, you know, you're so adverse to the water condition, you're so at home on the water that's, you know, I have way more hours on water than I do on land. And so understanding all of the aspects of, you know, what the water can throw at you, the gusts, the winds, the waves, the swells, the stuff like that, to go from one airplane to the next, it's all the same stuff that you have to focus on. Being a single hull, again, it's, you know, for scooping and stuff, you got the sponsons out there, everything you do at wings level. If you're turning on the water, scooping or whatever, it's wings level, crosswinds, that kind of stuff. You're going in basically with wings level, where, of course, on a float plane, you're going in and you can put the wing down and you can touch the upwind float first, you know, under the water and stuff, like you would on just like doing landing on wheels on a regular runway. You know, that kind of crosswind. So the boat requires a little bit, a few different techniques, but the transition from one to the other, really, there's not a big difference, because you understand, you know, the water part of things. So
yeah, exactly. What about you've got a lake, a river, some open ocean, or a coral cay, maybe from your Maldives days? What's been your favorite place to land a seaplane?
Well, not in the open ocean, that's for sure. Especially during the monsoon seasons in the Maldives, that's just nasty flying. It's a whole, takes it to another whole level. But they all have their own unique. I've scooped out of rivers and stuff before, and that's kind of fun. You know, it gets to be kind of fun doing that stuff. It's anything you can do that kind of breaks it up, the tight lagoons in the Maldives, that's kind of challenging with the Twin Otter, because some of the lagoons are pretty tight. So, you know, it requires some technique and, you know, full flaps on the Twin Otter and, you know, getting it stopped and stuff like that. So it's always nice to have a whole different realm of stuff to deal with, because then you never get complacent. You never get bored, I guess, on doing the same thing. So it's, I like them all. I like to take them all. I like a diversity like that.
Yep. Keep it diverse.
Yes.
No, that sounds fair enough. What about, is there an aircraft out there, seaplane wise or flying boat wise, that you haven't been able to fly yet that would be an absolute dream to get your hands on?
No, I don't know. After the CL415, you know, guys refer to it as the, it's a Super Cub on steroids, and it really is a very forgiving, It's a simple airplane to fly. The T is the same. The 215 was the same. It was just, of course, learning how to scoop a load of, get a load of water on it without wrecking it and hurting yourself, or being able to deliver it onto a fire. Those are the two things. So those airplanes kind of have always done it for me. You know, the Martin Mars, maybe because it's probably the only other one out there. That turbine Mallard you're flying, it sounds like it's would be a nice little race car to get into and go for a little joy around the patch. But Yeah, as far as seaplanes go, I never got to fly a Nordyne Norseman.
Yes.
And I always thought I'd like to have done a couple of circuits. I had an opportunity. It just didn't work out. But as far as seaplanes go, I think I've pretty much flown the ultimate, and not sure how it could get much better than that.
No, and the Norseman, I think, was it Mikey McBrien up in the Buffalo Airways? I think he's still got one on floats as well comes out every now and again. Buffalo Bill, isn't it?
Buffalo Joe.
Yes. Buffalo Joe, sorry. Buffalo Bill's a tasty ice cream.
Yeah. his dad, Joe McBrien, yeah.
He has
one, yes.
Yeah, so that'd be pretty crazy. That's a good answer, that one. Such history as well, and very early days. I think they were built in the 30s or something, weren't they?
Yes. They're the same vintage as the PBY, the Canso. So they're kind of the same era.
Yeah. Mate, a couple more questions here. You've got a glass out day on a lake. What aircraft would you want to be in?
Glassy day. You know what? Probably, you know, again, the ultimate bush plane is the de Havilland Beaver. You know, it's... You know, if you're in a glassy water day, it's the de Havilland Beaver. The Beach 18 was real nice too on glassy water. It handled it very nice. But probably, yeah, in a roundabout way, probably the de Havilland Beaver would be the one that would least nice. Likely to get yourself into any sort of trouble with.
Right. what about some rough water open ocean? What are you going to be in then?
Well, the Twin Otter, because I've been there, done that, and I know it'll take it day in and day out. It's absolutely amazing what that airplane takes on a daily basis. But even the CL-415, I've been in some big swells with it and rough water, and the 215 as well, and they can handle it. But for sure, it'd be the open sea, rough water try. And if I had to get in there to hopefully survive, it'd be the Twin Otter for sure.
What was the PBY like in that kind of open ocean swell areas?
Well, the PBY had you had to be very careful with it because of its hull design. It would porpoise on you. And luckily, I never, ever got it into a porpoise. But I know guys like senior captains have said that you've got three porpoises. And within three porpoises, either you have that thing under control or she's coming unglued. It wouldn't be a very good airplane in big open swells and stuff like that. The CL-215 or 415 would handle it much better because its hull design is quite a bit different.
Yeah, okay. What about piston or turbine seaplane? You've flown a lot of different variants of both. What's been your favorite?
Well, again, the Beach 18, it's hard to, you know, the Twin Otter with PT-6s, you know, it's funny because, you know, I flew piston engines for, I don't know, 25 years. And I remember saying, you know, oh my God, we got to get turbines, you know, these pistons, we got to get rid of these pistons, you know, turbines, they're the answer. They're so safe. They're so reliable. And I started thinking back in 25 years, I never had a piston engine let me down.
Yeah, well.
Yeah, you know, and that's in the 2800s fighting forest fire, you know, like power on, power off, you know, 100 plus times a day. And the PBY with the 1830s, the Beavers Beach 18s with the Pratt & Whitney 985s. I flew a standard Otter just a little bit, basically got checked out on it with the 1340. I didn't really care for that airplane. Again, I think because I didn't get enough time in it to feel comfortable with. In all the years, I never had a piston engine let me down. But then I kept thinking, God, we got to get these turbines because they're so much more reliable, so much safer. But definitely turbine engines today for sure. You wouldn't want to go back if you didn't have to.
Fair enough. Best looking seaplane or flying boat, float plane?
Oh, Beach 18. Oh, yes. It's
especially when it's all, you know, polished aluminium. Oh, how good does that look?
Yeah, we had the company at Northwest Flying, we had two that were all polished aluminum with just green, forest green trim on them. And they were beautiful. And then And then I worked at Rusty Myers. We had the same thing. We had four of them, and they were all polished aluminum with just white and black and yellow trim on them. And, yeah, they were beautiful. They have to be by far the best-looking airplane on floats for sure.
Nice. Last question, mate. You've been around for a long time now flying in the float plane world and flying boat world, obviously. What advice would you have for people trying to get into this for a career, especially the firebombing kind of aspect of it? What kind of advice would you give to them?
Well, first of all, make sure you have a very understanding wife.
I've heard that before.
That's key to everything. You know, my wife, and, well, I mentioned you earlier, you know, we before my PBY days, we went backpacking around Southeast Asia and tramped around Australia, got married in Perth, Australia, actually. And 36 years later, we're still here. And I have two wonderful kids. My son is a captain in the Canadian Air Force.
Oh, wow.
My daughter has a career here in town. I have two beautiful grandchildren that live less than 10 minutes from me. And it, you know, it's all about, you know, I owe it all to my wife. Like I said earlier, she used to say I was home just long enough to screw up the routine. And so she was at home. She kept things together and stuck by me. I know it's not the easiest when you're, you know, I'm going to be home on Thursday night for sure. I'm going to be home. And, well, honey, I'm just going to be maybe one more week, you know, or whatever. And fires broke out. So that, you know what? You got to have, whether it's a girlfriend, a partner, whatever, you got to have somebody that's very understanding, and they've got to understand that it's a passion. And if it's not a passion, then don't chase it because of just a paycheck. It's you've got to want to do it, and chase the dream. And if it's your dream, chase it. And you know, a lot of it is networking. It's you know, stop by a tanker base and get to meet guys. And, you know, it's pound the chief pilots. Find out what you need for, you know, what their minimums are. Make sure you go after that, you know, and go. And you might have to maybe go buy yourself a rating. You might have to go and live in the north for 6 months to get the experience that you need, or a year or somewhere that you don't want to be. But if it's the dream, then follow it and do what it's going to take. And it's not going to get handed to you, because there's other people chasing that same dream. So the big thing is get to know people. I can't even begin to guess how many people I've helped get jobs over the years, because people helped me get jobs. And that's just the way the industry goes. And you hope people will step up and help the next guy. But the big thing is find out what the requirements are, get to know people, and don't give up.
Yeah, no, it's some great advice, mate, especially with the family side of things. I know that probably not enough emphasis is put on, you know, the actual lifestyle behind these jobs and how tough it is on families and partners. And, you know, as you mentioned there, you've got grandkids now. So, you know, being away from them for a season would be very tough as well. So it's not just all about the flying. It's about making sure that you've got a happy family behind you who are supportive. So, yeah, very much well said on that.
Yeah, that's key. You know, I can tell so many stories of, you know, like, you know, calling my wife saying, I'm landing in Dryden. Could you bring me some clean clothes, you know, and meeting her in the parking lot at the hangar and, you know, giving her a hug and a kiss and the kids a hug and a kiss and pulling dirty clothes out of a bag and putting clean clothes in and saying, okay, I'll see you, you know, next week. I got to go and you're off to another base. You know, it's so, you know, there's and every tanker pilot or scooper pilot, they've got the same stories that they can tell. And somebody strong behind you that's willing to accept this crazy lifestyle, that's key.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Al, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the step, mate, and talking all things float planes and flying boats and your amazing career. I really appreciate you taking the time out to have a chat and share your story with everyone. And, yeah, as I mentioned, I'd like to thank you very much for coming on the step.
Well, Dan, thanks for having me, and it was great meeting you, and all the best with your podcast. It's, I think you're onto a great thing here, and there's certainly people in the industry that have many more stories than I have and have been around even longer than me. have a lot to contribute. So all the best to you. Thank you.
Cheers, mate. And that's the show for today, folks. What a great guest Al was, and thanks a lot to him for taking the time to share his experiences flying that incredible purpose-built machine. It certainly would be an incredible job. However, hats off to his family, as it would also be incredibly tough to have him gone for those long lengths of time. Just goes to show how much these heroes sacrifice to ensure lives and property are saved from these fire events. I'm sure you'll all get behind me to say thanks for your support. Now is the time to share this episode, tell a friend, and review with Apple Podcasts. I love hearing your reviews, folks. I had a great review from Hayden Clintsmith the other day, who is an airline pilot wanting to get his float rating after flying with Steve Pemberton in the Beaver at Airwit Sunday. Good on you, Hayden. Folks, also On The Step is proudly sponsored by the Seaplane Pilots Association. Their mission is to be the voice of the seaplane community and to represent the interests of seaplane enthusiasts on the federal, state, and local levels. It includes ensuring fairness and equality for seaplanes to share public waterways with all other user groups. The SPA achieved this on a variety of levels, providing their members with a host of benefits by working with government organisations, insurance companies, manufacturers, other aviation advocacy organisations, and seaplane training schools and instructors to create a positive environment for seaplane flying and ownership. I highly recommend joining the Seaplane Pilots Association, and the SPA has given me a link for On The Step fans to become members, and that link is in the show notes, so go check them out. Next time, I finally speak with the man everyone has been waiting for, the Martin Mars man, Mr. Peter Killen.
We go out depending on our status, but most times we'll go out and warm the aircraft up and be ready to go, because each oil tank is 90 gallons. I think the capacity is like 110 gallons, but top X on the dipstick is 90 gallons. So it takes 45 minutes to get all the oil up to 10. So if we got to do an immediate departure, we're 45 minutes. So we go out in the morning and do a warm up and a short flight back for a little bit of currency, because it's a really busy airplane. And then we land, pull up to the buoy. Now we're ready to go. We can hop in the airplane because that oil heat sinks, and it takes a long time for 100 gallons of oil to come out at 40 C.
Until next time, everyone, thanks for coming on The Step.